Good morning.
A few weeks ago, a physician named Ezekiel Emanuel wrote an article in The Atlantic called "Why Hope to Die at 75. In it, he explained that the moment he turns 75 years old, he will no longer try to live forever. He has drawn a bit of heat for his statements, but I, for one, couldn't be more grateful of the timing. You see, for the better part of a year now, I've been trying to find the right words to talk to the congregation about death. And Dr. Emanuel's article helped me finally find my words. Let me start by telling you a little bit about myself. I'm an acute care nurse practitioner and a cardiologist. My average patient age is 84 years old. Prior to being a nurse practitioner, I was an ICU nurse, a heart and lung surgical nurse, a hospice secretary and volunteer, and a nurse's aide in a typical nursing home. I have taken care of patients at every point on the dying timeline, from the moment they are told they are dying, to the moment they die, to after death, when the body must be washed and prepared for transfer to the funeral home or the morgue. I have been the one to tell patients they are dying and to guess how long they have to live. I have had to perform CPR, which means resuscitating a dead person, and I know what it feels like to crack ribs with my bare hands and to have to keep going. I have yet to sign a death certificate, but I will tell you it is part of my job description. I have seen patients with the proverbial nine lives repeatedly pulled back from the brink, only to languish in hospitals begging to die when it became clear that continued existence means continued suffering. I have seen death and dying and suffering every day doing what I do for a living, and it is these experiences that compel me to share my concerns with you today. In America, we have a problem with death. The problem is not so much that we will eventually die, we know this. It's that we don't seem to know how. We are living and breathing beings, and despite our best efforts and the strongest of wills, we all one day will die. The causes will vary, but the basic principles are the same for every one of us in this room. One day, our hearts will stop beating, our lungs will stop taking in air, and our brains will stop thinking. Our souls will go wherever it is that souls go, but they will no longer be in this, our body. And the people we each are known as will cease to exist in the way that we exist now. This is permanent, undeniable, and completely unfathomable. Again, the problem is not that we will eventually die, or even that many of us are afraid to. Even though we know that no one has lived forever, the real problem is our culture and the American immortal. Since the mid-19th century, Americans have been living longer. In 1900, the life expectancy of an average American was just 47 years at birth. By 1930, it was 59 years. In 1960, it was 69 years. And by 1990, it was 75 years. So my toddler today can expect to live about 81 years, which is almost twice what she could have expected to live had she been born 100 years ago. Why did life expectancy increase? Because we learned to prevent the things that killed us. At the turn of the century, infectious disease was the number one cause of death. So we developed vaccines and aggressive public health campaigns that promote hygiene and the germ theory of illness. The result? Fewer people died young. Around the 1960s, physicians and researchers started investigating ways to treat chronic illness. Innovations in stroke, heart disease, cancer, organ transplantation, and so on, meaning fewer people died in middle age. This was how we created the American immortal, a notion that by lengthening our lives, we will have more healthy and happy years. That disability and suffering will be short and limited to just a few days at the end of life. It's a really nice thought. The idea that there might exist this fountain of youth and that our doctors hold the key. Medicine has spent many decades and many dollars pursuing this goal. So where are we now? In 1998, about 28% of American men age 80 and older had a functional limitation. And by functional limitation, I mean something such as the inability to walk a quarter of a mile, climb 10 stairs, or stand or sit for 2 hours straight. A quarter of men in 1998. By 2006, less than 10 years later, that 28% of men over the age of 80 became 42%. 42% of men over the age of 80 had a functional limitation. And for women, it was over 50%. Research at the University of Washington and Harvard has proven that while we have increased our life expectancy, we have increased the absolute number of years lost to disability. So in other words, 30 years ago, maybe we died a few years younger, but we did so spending less overall time disabled. The bottom line, healthcare hasn't slowed the aging process, it's slowed the dying process. Here are a few more sobering facts about living longer. Today, approximately 5 million Americans over 65 are living with Alzheimer's. Over 85 years old, it's 1 in 3 Americans. And by 2050, researchers predict that that number will increase by 300%. Nearly half of all Americans die in a hospital, and about 70% of Americans die in a hospital, nursing home, or other long-term care facility, which means only about 25% of individuals die at home, despite 80% of people with chronic illness saying they don't want to be in a hospital or intensive care. Today, Americans are living longer than their parents, but they are more likely to be incapacitated at the end of life. The length of time they will spend being disabled is longer. The degree of disable they will experience is more intense. Let me tell you about a recent patient of mine, Mr. H. During the 7 months that I knew him, he spent more days in the ICU than anywhere else, including home. There were 7 different doctors treating his numerous medical conditions. This team of doctors held multiple meetings with his family, trying to explain to them how sick he was and the fact that the odds of him ever recovering completely were really, really slim. At the same time, the family was constantly complaining that he was suffering and we weren't doing enough to fix him. The treatments were painful and exhausting, and as a result, Mr. H's family often refused elements of his care they felt caused him immediate suffering, despite our explaining the long-term benefit of each treatment. Mr. H was not getting better, and in many ways, he was deteriorating very slowly. One day when I went to see him, Mr. H asked me, "When can I go home?" I tried to explain that his prognosis was not good, even with us doing everything we possibly could. If he wanted to, he could stop treatment and go home on hospice within a day. His daughter asked me to step into the hall, where she yelled at me that I was taking away his hope and making him depressed. She asked me not to see him anymore. Our team met again with Mr. H's family and explained if they really want his suffering to stop, they had the option to forgo further treatment. Because continued treatment meant continued suffering. We let that sink into the room a little bit because without treatment, that slim chance of him ever getting better was completely gone. His wife smacked her fist and stood up angrily. "It is not right for us to decide his fate. I am not going to be the one to decide when my husband dies, and I can't believe you are asking this of me. When it's his time to go, God will take him." My colleagues and I have amazing technological power to prolong life. We can bring people back from the dead. But there are limits. Again, no one has ever lived forever, despite what they say in Twilight. When you see your medical provider, you need to think about what it is you are actually asking them to do and how you are going to communicate that. Are you seeking a relief of your symptoms? What if your symptoms can't be relieved? What's the cost, emotionally, physically, financially, of treatment? I'll be honest, most of us providers are not good at communicating these things or understanding the result you actually want to achieve. And many of us, we're people pleasers, and we want to provide hope, especially because we often get accused of taking away hope. And if we don't get accused of taking away hope, we get accused of creating false expectations. We walk a razor-thin line with patients like Mr. H. Sometimes we get carried away trying to look at the positive and forget to ground you in reality, because many providers equate cure and treatment with relief. Sometimes that's true, but sometimes it isn't. Whether or not healthcare is a basic human right, the pursuit of longevity is a choice. It's easy to think of it as a choice when you think of a chronic smoker refusing to quit. When you're in pain or suffering, it may not seem like much of a choice to go to the emergency room, but it is one. Let's revisit Dr. Emanuel again. What he's saying in his article is not that he intends or even expects to die at age 75. He's saying that on his 75th birthday, he will no longer visit the doctor, and he will no longer go to the emergency room when he feels ill. He will stop all cancer screenings and preventative testing. He probably won't even get his flu shot. The purpose of any medications he takes will be to relieve symptoms, not cure illness. There will be no more antibiotics. If he gets a pneumonia, then death will come as it did for those at the turn of the century, quickly, over a few days. This is Dr. Emanuel's answer to the American immortal, to recognize that he is mortal. When I was workshopping this sermon, I gave the example of an elderly patient with an extensive list of active medical problems coming into my clinic for a routine appointment. He had spent at least 2 days of each week for the past 3 months going to doctor's appointments for his various maladies. The other days of the week were spent caring for his wife, who could no longer care for herself and had even more medical appointments than he did. He seemed a little depressed during our appointment, so it was my obligation to ask him more about that. At my age, in my condition, I can't do any of the things I once did for fun. There is no fun anymore. I used to teach at a university. I used to be a wise counselor to my children and help them through their lives. My wife and I would travel and we played tennis. My wife can't remember my name anymore. My children treat me like a child. All of my lifelong friends are dead or have moved away. And he started to cry. I did too. We sat for a moment in silence, and then I had to explain to him that there was no medication, no treatment I could offer him, nothing that I or any of his other providers could really do to alleviate his physical suffering. And then I had to ask him what he expects to happen next. The feedback I received when I workshopped that story, which is based on a true story, was that what I was telling this man was traumatizing. And what could one possibly do after a conversation like that? Having been through more than one of these encounters, I can assure you that it's every bit as heartbreaking as it sounds. I have had more than one patient cry during my appointments, and I have had more than one patient call me heartless and say I had no idea what it was like to sit in their chair and face that kind of question. I went into nursing specifically to alleviate suffering and care for others who could not care for themselves. And when I see the suffering my patients are coming to me with now, I can't help but wonder, how could we have prevented this? We have this incredible power of freedom and autonomy in America. But as a favorite comic book hero said best, with great power comes great responsibility. At some point, the power that we have over our own bodies requires us to have the responsibility and forethought to think about what happens down the road. If it sounds harsh to ask someone how he or she wants to die, it's because it is. That's why your medical provider will often hide behind buzzwords and lingo like living will and advanced directive. The truth is, we're asking you how you want to die. As providers, we actually need you to tell us, because no matter what we fix or treat, you will still get older, and your body will still break down and eventually die. So at what point do you say enough? As Americans, we take great umbrage at the idea of anyone else telling us when to stop fighting. And as a little sidebar, that's how the whole death panel myth got spun way out of control. Over the past half century, Americans have created a medical system that is legally required to treat when asked. So even when I know I cannot fix your problem, or that by fixing your problem, you're not going to feel better, my colleagues and I, we're obligated to keep trying because you asked us to. We're obligated to tell you, but it often falls on deaf ears. Which is why we have to ask you now to decide, when is it enough? The discussion about when and how you want to die is hard enough. It gets even more complicated when we discuss the thought of our parents dying. More often than I can count, my elderly patients have come to me saying their child wants them to have everything done. I get alarm bells when I hear this. Whether you are 10 years old, 50 years old, or 80 years old, it is never a good time to say goodbye to a parent. You will never be old enough for it. You will never be ready for it. Watching your parents die is brutal and a traumatic coming-of-age experience. Much like adolescence, however, it's something we all have to go through. And just like adolescence, only a lucky few come through without any permanent scars. Your parents, my parents, my child's parents, our spouses, will all eventually die. In some ways, that's even harder than recognizing that we ourselves will die. Dr. Emmanuel notes that his children are adamantly opposed to his decision. They're trying to talk him out of it. They want him to keep fighting. Like many people out there, I abhor the thought of saying goodbye to my own mother. But eventually I will have to do it. As I mentioned earlier, many Americans are living longer lives disabled, which means many of our elderly are depending on their children or spouses to be their caregivers. Though the body reverts to a state of dependence, these elderly impaired are still adults that still fight to remain autonomous. And if you can't imagine that, or if you doubt it, recall, or imagine if you haven't had it, the conversation with an elderly person about when to take away the car keys. If you love your parents or your spouse, talk to them about what you both expect during the declining years. Communicate. Talk about what matters to you them. What would make them happy as they age? What does it mean to surrender that driver's license, and when do you both think that should happen? How do they want to die? How do they not want to die? What do they want to get from doctor's visits? Put it in real practical terms, because it's really easy to say, I don't want to die in pain. Okay, well, most of us don't, but there's more to it than that. Get down to the nitty-gritty. Maybe what they really want to feel satisfied and fulfilled is to meet their great-grandchildren. Maybe the fine line between I've had enough, I've had a good life, is the moment I can't go fishing anymore. How will they feel if they can't get what they want? What is too much disability? And talk about what happens before and after they hit that point. Because it's easy to say, I don't want this to happen. But then what do you do when it does? Sacrifice your protective bubble to start talking about it. And again, later when it's time to respect those wishes. Because having witnessed it over and over again, pushing for your mom or your dad or your other loved one to keep fighting after they've already given up does not change the fact that they will die. The experience will be sad, it'll be tragic regardless of the when. And if you can focus on loving and the quality of the time that you have together at the end, you can avoid a lot of the suffering of fighting a battle you will lose. We have a duty to talk to those we love and then respect their rights over their own bodies. Not to make our loved ones feel guilty for not wanting to suffer or for wanting to rest instead of fight. After so many years of the hard work that is living, haven't they earned the right to say it's time for a rest? As a medical provider, I've learned no one ever knows a body better than the person living in it. To everyone in the congregation, I say that you need to initiate a conversation now with those that you love and those that you know will mourn your passing. We all know someone's going to attend our funerals. If you think someone you love could ever possibly have to make this decision on your behalf of how or when you will die, now's the time to talk to them about it. Let them know how you feel and when and how to make that decision for you. These decisions happen every single day where I work. I don't know that I agree with Ezekiel Emanuel that I will stop seeing the doctor at age 75 or that I'll tell my parents to stop seeing the doctor at age 75. Based on my current experiences, I do know what I don't want. And there will come a point of no return to avoid that from happening. And I know that that point happens either in that clinic with that patient or probably sometime before it. I know it doesn't happen in the hospital. I know this is an unpleasant topic for many to talk about, but I hope that you will walk away from today's service not with grief, depression, or fear, but with a feeling of empowerment, a realization that you have this power and this autonomy and freedom now. You are in the driver's seat of your own life. You don't need to be a passenger. And that includes all the rights and responsibilities of being the driver.